Nearly every treatment algorithm for OCD has antipsychotics somewhere in its branches. But watch out, these medications have a few surprises in store. Welcome to the Carlette Psychiatry Podcast, keeping psychiatry honest since 2003.
I'm Chris Aiken, the editor-in-chief of the Carlette Psychiatry Report.
And I'm Kelly Newsom, a psychiatric NP and a dedicated reader of every issue. In 1957, Donald Klein introduced a term that we've wrestled with on this podcast, pharmacologic dissection. The idea was that you could define, diagnose, and generally tease apart psychiatric disorders by their response to medications. And if you're an optimist, the glass is half full on this one. But for many of our patients, that glass is half empty, particularly when it comes to OCD. Take this example. Compulsive behavior is a well-known side effect of psychostimulants like methylphenidate and amphetamines. Watch for it. If the dose goes too high, you might see compulsive and repetitive behaviors of all sorts, including nail biting, tics, and overt OCD. 1 out of 14 people who abuse stimulants develop OCD on them. But flip the glass over, and we see a different picture. Stimulants can also treat OCD. Methylphenidate successfully augmented fluvoxamine in 2 small randomized controlled trials, even though there are case reports of methylphenidate inducing OCD. This month, we featured an interview with Michael Poyarovsky on the overlap of schizophrenia and OCD. It's a fairly common syndrome. Obsessive-compulsive symptoms have been recognized in schizophrenia for decades, and the overlap is informally known as schizo-OCD. There's a lot to know about this overlap, and in today's podcast, we're going to focus on a particular paradox it brings up, that antipsychotics can both cause and treat OCD.
I'll start with 2 cases from my own practice, one acute and one insidious. As always, we've changed some details for confidentiality. Case 1. A patient with bipolar disorder came in to see me in a mixed state, and I started aripiprazole, Abilify. Within a few days, she developed a paralyzing fear that she was going to cause harm to someone. It was full-blown OCD. She was unable to drive for fear that she might accidentally roll over someone lying on the road. At home, she feared she might pick up a knife and stab her children. The fear was so intense that she went to the emergency room and was hospitalized. It all resolved when aripiprazole was stopped, and she had no history of OCD before this or ever since. Next is a case of a man with intractable psychosis. His psychotic illness came on in his early 20s, and fortunately, before it started, he was able to complete college and got married to another man. But now he was inching ever closer to losing it all, his marriage and his job, because of unrelenting paranoia and hallucinations. After a few antipsychotic failures, I started clozapine, and he recovered completely, saving his marriage and his job. But slowly, something else started to creep in. He worried about doing everything just right. Did he wash the dishes in the right order, wash his hands correctly, lock the doors, forget something at home? The obsessive doubting was wearing down his marriage more than the psychosis had. It's easier, you know, for a spouse to detach from psychosis, to separate the person from the illness there because there's such a clear distinction. But OCD looks enough like normality that it can start to seem intentional, and spouses can lose compassion for the behavior. There was no room for intimacy of any type as the patient badgered his husband day and night with obsessive questions seeking reassurance for his unquenchable doubt. The marriage ended. When I treated these patients, the literature was full of randomized controlled trials showing that antipsychotics treated OCD, augmenting SSRIs and sometimes working on their own. It was enough to make me wonder that what I was seeing might be a false association. Random noise that had nothing to do with the medications. But there was an older literature, before the glossy dawn of the atypicals, suggesting that antipsychotics can do the opposite, cause or worsen OCD. It's also clear from animal research that dopamine is somehow involved in OCD, but in which direction? So I asked Dr. Poryevsky, can antipsychotics flip the switch both ways?
I agree with you. It's actually the bidirectional. When you have the positive therapeutic effect of atypical antipsychotics, there are some data on olanzapine and low-dose clozapine in patients with schizo-obsessive disorder. And you have a lot of observations, open-label studies, showing that the same medications, clozapine and olanzapine primarily, may cause or exacerbate obsessive pre-existing and obsessive compulsive symptoms in patients with schizophrenia.
Of all the antipsychotics, clozapine is most likely to cause OCD. How often does this happen on clozapine?
I would say 10 to 15% is a reasonable percentage.
That's a lot of patients.
Big number. And I'm considering full-blown sin. If you take into consideration symptoms, obsessive-compulsive symptoms, I believe that the numbers would be even higher.
On the other hand, you suggested earlier that, in your experience, low-dose clozapine might be helpful in OCD with schizophrenia?
Low dose, we actually published some clinical observations several years ago and others as well in the United States. I know that clozapine in limited dose range, low dose range, may be effective in amelioration of both schizophrenic and obsessive compulsive symptoms.
What is the low dose range?
It's actually 150 milligrams. Okay, when you keep rising the dose during the uptake titration of clozapine, you may have the opposite effect, provoking OCD effect.
Is the general consensus that this is a dose-response relationship with most antipsychotics, that if you go too high, you get more OCD?
Yes, this is an impression. We don't have evidence, but this is an impression. More 5-HT2 antagonism you have with an increased dose, more OCD-provoking effect.
Okay, so it may not be a dopamine effect. It may be serotonin 5-HT2A antagonism that's causing the OCD?
Right, right.
Are there other 5-HT2A antagonists besides the antipsychotics that we should worry about causing OCD?
So actually, it's a good question. Mirtazapine, for example, is a very important 5-HT2 antagonist. There are some cases of OCD-provoking effect.
Are some antipsychotics more likely to cause OCD?
I think that clozapine and olanzapine, they're more prone to exacerbate or to induce the OCD.
That's interesting because quetiapine is an analog of clozapine, but there are controlled studies in bipolar disorder and OCD where quetiapine treated OCD. Can quetiapine also cause OCD?
Quetiapine, there are some observations and case reports, but it seems that quetiapine just its potential to induce OCD is lower than clozapine.
You mentioned that antipsychotics might cause OCD through serotonin 5-HT2A antagonism, and I understand this is all theoretical and we don't have solid evidence, but do you have any idea how they treat OCD? Is that through dopamine?
I think that the most solid evidence of the involvement of dopaminergic system in OCD is the efficacy, therapeutic efficacy, of low dose of D2 dopamine receptor antagonists, primarily risperidone, allopurinol, in patients with pure OCD.
What doses are you talking about for these ones that help OCD?
It's a low dosages of both risperidone. I would say 2.5 to 5 milligrams of allopurinol.
And for risperidone, what dosage?
It's 2 to 3 milligrams. Definitely not 6.
As I talk with Dr. Poyarovsky, I realized we are getting into some confusing territory. There are a lot of unknowns here. Antipsychotics affect many different neurotransmitter systems, and pharmacologic dissection with them is not going to be a straight line. In our online interview, Dr. Poyarovsky shares more about antipsychotics that are more or less favorable in schizo-OCD, the risks and benefits of using SSRIs in this population, as well as other pharmacologic and non-pharmacologic treatments that he finds helpful for patients whose psychotic symptoms overlap with OCD.
This is a very dicey area of psychopharmacology. Schizophrenia can cause OCD even without medications on board. And antipsychotics can cause or worsen OCD. And the problem extends beyond schizophrenia. Bipolar disorder doesn't exactly cause OCD, but OCD is much more common in the bipolar population than it is in the general public. So when you see a patient with these comorbidities, it's hard to know if it's a separated condition, a medication effect, or if the medication is helping it, just not all the way.
Or it could be a false positive. Lots of patients have OCD-like symptoms who don't have OCD. I've seen people with post-traumatic stress disorder, for example, who count things to self-soothe, and they don't do it out of any compulsion. It's done in response to clear PTSD triggers. I've seen compulsive behaviors in ADHD that patients do when they are bored and distracted, and it goes away when treated with a stimulant.
Dr. Poyarovsky also mentions in his interview that some patients with schizophrenia have OCD-like symptoms that aren't due to OCD at all, that are false positives. For example, akathisia can make people ask repetitive questions and seek reassurance in a compulsive way.
Akathisia is associated with marked obsessionality. For example, repetitive, intrusive asking questions. If your patient just comes to you and he starts to ask you repetitive questions despite your repetitive answer, be careful, this is akathisia. If you recently started antipsychotics.
He also described cases that resemble body dysmorphic disorder in schizophrenia.
Sometimes it's a typical BDD, body dysmorphic disorder, like non-schizophrenia BDD. Sometimes it's a complex disorder when delusional thinking, BDD is more delusional than OCD. Okay, but in schizophrenia, you may have this very complex psychopathological construct associated with both delusions, hallucinations, and body dysmorphic experiences.
Modern psychopharmacology was born in the 1950s, and we've come a long way in sorting out which psychotropics are best for which disorders. But the dissection is not as clean as we hoped for. Antidepressants can treat anxiety and cause anxiety. They can even trigger suicidal ideation in patients under age 25. We now know that just because a patient's mood gets worse on an antidepressant, it doesn't mean they have bipolar disorder. To learn more about conditions that worsen on antidepressants, check out our February 15th podcast from earlier this year, 6 Depressions That Can Worsen on Antidepressants.
Michael Poyarovsky is a professor of psychiatry at the Ma'el Ham Carmel Mental Health Center, Tirat Carmel, Israel. He is the author of the textbook Schizo-Obsessive Disorder and is releasing a new book on the subject soon. And now for the word of the day, failed trial.
Sometimes drugs fail to work, and sometimes it's the study that fails. But when you see a disappointing outcome in a clinical trial, how do you know if the fault lies with the drug or with the study? That's where you need to understand the difference between a negative trial and a failed trial. In a negative trial, it's the drug that's the problem. The drug came up negative, no better than placebo. It simply didn't work. A good example is gabapentin, Neurontin, which failed to separate from placebo in several randomized controlled trials of mania. atomoxetine, Strattera, for depression, and aripiprazole, Abilify, for ADHD, and vortioxetine, Trintellix, for generalized anxiety disorder are all other examples of negative trials. By contrast, in a failed trial, it's the study that was the problem. Maybe it didn't enroll enough subjects, or maybe there were too many dropouts, or maybe the placebo response was inflated. That can happen when the investigators provide a lot of support to the study subjects, or they enroll a lot of people with mild conditions that are highly responsive to placebo. When you see a trial with a disappointing result, how do you know if it was the drug or the study that failed? Sometimes the investigators will try to cast blame on the study. Often they argue that the placebo response was higher than expected, but that's all speculation. The true test of whether a study failed is one that's unfortunately rarely used. The trial would have to have three arms: a placebo, the new drug, and a similar drug that is already well known to work. The placebo is there to test the new drug, and the other, well-established drug is there to test the study. Lurisidone, Latuda, has a failed study in schizophrenia where neither lurisidone nor haloperidone, Haldol, separated from placebo. And one of the most famous examples of a failed trial was a randomized controlled trial of St. John's wort from 2002. The study was large and well-designed, enrolling 360 patients with major depression, but neither St. John's wort nor the otherwise effective sertraline worked any better than placebo. All we can conclude is that the placebo response was so great in that study that both drugs failed, even though both drugs have proven their merit in other studies. The study is often presented as proof that St. John's wort doesn't work. But the truth is much more mundane. It was the study that failed, full of sound and fury, but ultimately signifying nothing. This month, we report on a series of negative studies of an atypical antipsychotic in mania, and the next week's podcast will tally the best and worst antipsychotics for mania.
1 in 5 U.S. psychiatrists subscribe to The Carlat Report, and you too can join the fun at thecarlatreport.com, where new subscribers get $30 off with the promo code PODCAST. We have the original Carlat Report for general psychiatry and specialized editions for child, addictions, hospital, and, coming soon, a geropsych edition. All of them operating free of commercial support.